Welcome to the Voices for Voices TV show podcast. I am your host, Justin Allen Hayes, executive director and founder of Voices for Voices. If you could do us a big favor and like and share this episode so we can reach more people, we'd really appreciate it. So today's episode is going to be a little bit different. We're joined in studio by our guest who we had on episode number 98. Her name is Stacy Hayes, and we've kind of talked about flipping the script. So this episode is going to be with Stacy taking the lead and asking questions about my past and childhood and how we got to where we're at today. So Stacy, thanks for coming back and joining us again.
Justin, how's it going?
Very good.
I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, glad to have you. And excited to see the evolution of how this goes. Kind of nervous.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, it's a little different when you flip the script a little bit, huh?
Yeah.
So when I was here for my interview, that was something that I offered to you, was to kind of come and interview you. So what kind of made you make the choice that, yes, this is something I'd like to do?
I think the big thing was, well, timing, making sure that we could fit it in and get it in, mm-hmm. in this season. And then really trying to take the organization and what we're doing really down to the foundation of how we got started, what my influencers were growing up, and to where we're at today. And so all those things kind of culminated and were able to get scheduled, and so wanted to do it. So
yeah.
As we'll talk a little bit later with sharing my mental health story kind of with the world through book form, this is also sharing some of the backstory for those that may have seen episodes, heard of the organization, seen social media posts, and wanted to get a little more in-depth about us and the organization.
And I think this is something your listeners will really appreciate too. Because what I find so compelling about your organization is that it genuinely is elevating the stories of others. And in a time where everyone is screaming to have their voices heard, you are using it to amplify the story of others, which I just absolutely connect with and love. So to start out with, just tell us a little bit about how you grew up.
Yeah, grew up Northeast Ohio, Massillon, Ohio. I have a sister 4 years older than me. Parents, mother and father, they're still together today, and they were a big influence on doing family activities when we were able to go into ball games, when money was available, discretionary, we would go on family vacations, and so enjoyed the time, whether it was at the beach or at Disney, or really just hanging out with family. And then sports were very important to me, and I didn't realize at the time how much those experiences were really engulfed in who I was as an individual, and how much of that I took on as my personality versus time away from sports. So as we'll continue, kind of separation anxiety from that as I started to grow. Started to creep in, kind of discovering who I was as an individual away from sports became tough.
So big football town, because you're in North Canton.
Big football town, mm-hmm. Family-wise, bigger baseball okay. family, so every Indians game. You have on the radio, they weren't quite to the point where they were on TV every game. Grandparents, we would make two or three trips to the stadium as a family to go to a game, and then we would actually stop at Belgrade Garden in Barberton to get chicken dinner on the way back home from the game. So that was
is that where they used to put the loaves of bread on the table?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it still there?
I believe so. Yeah. Okay. They had a couple locations, and I think the flagship one is the one only standing.
Okay. So not only are you describing kind of this, like, personal relationship with sports, but it was also, like, this family kind of to-do.
It was, yeah, very okay. much so.
So what's, you said baseball was the one that you connected to the most?
Yes.
Okay, what? What about baseball? What was it?
I think I was good at it at a young age. Did well on kind of the regular season team and made multiple all-star mm-hmm. teams and was able to do some traveling and play against some teams kind of outside the local area. And I was getting a lot of playing time, and I felt good and just that I was naturally good at it. And so I was like, oh, well, I'm good at this. So it's the season, so we're going to practice and go from there. And so I'd say from, like, I say, like maybe like age 9 to 12 or so, it was heavily influenced where I was at kind of at the top of the game, making all the all-star games, all-star teams, one of the top pitchers. So we would play tournaments. Mm-hmm. I was asked to start. And so I felt that I was good enough to do that. An outsider's view, I'm not sure. That's just kind of like how I mm-hmm. felt, kind of going through the process, that that I was good enough to do these things, so I was just going to continue. And then also did basketball, and then at a smaller degree, soccer. But baseball was kind of the mindset of, like, seeing myself in the World Series playing, kind of. Yeah. Dreaming.
Well, as a young kid, too, that, like, absolutely consumed your life. And what you're almost explaining to me is, like, it consumed your identity.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So what was that like? You're 12 years old, and mm-hmm. you're trying to kind of transition to high school, like, you know, yeah. 13, 14 years old, kind of mm-hmm. moving from there. How were you able to grow these other parts of your personality?
So I really wasn't. Interpersonal relationships, very awkward. I had braces twice, had a lot of acne on my face, so a lot of just kind of those types of growing pains. Never really, I'm going to say never, but didn't feel part of a group or part of, even though I was playing sports and on teams, kind of away from the field, away from the gym, use this as an example. I wasn't being asked to go to parties or to hang out with the cool kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, what's going on? I'm on a team and I'm playing and I'm not included. And so these, you know, disparities of, oh, well, so-and-so's parents are doctors or lawyers. Mm-hmm. And so that whole judging, while I didn't want to do it, I was kind of doing it because I'm like, well, I'm being put in this position just psychologically, even if it wasn't. Yeah. True, didn't make their parents any better than mine. It was just, well, the lawyers and their kids hang out and the like, and, you know, I'm driving a Sand Brown minivan, and they're driving, at the time, brand new Eclipses, mm-hmm. and some BMWs, and so just from that, it was like, oh, okay, well, we don't want to have Justin come with us and hang out. Now, whether they had those conversations, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's just how I felt.
Yeah, well, just extremely isolated.
Isolated, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's not what so many teenagers experience, and like a very common narrative, but when you're in it, you feel so alone and so, like, unrelatable, and it's just like the last thing you want to feel as a teenager is feeling like you don't belong anywhere.
Yes.
So how did you work through that?
Really, I'll say I didn't for all these answers. But I really, really didn't. I had, again, trying to fall back on what I knew with sports, feeling that I had been good for so long that was going to continue into high school. Well, freshman year, that didn't happen. I didn't make the JV team, even though playing many years with the same kids, I felt I was as good, if not better. And so I was kind of relegated, and I'm like, well, what's going on? What's the deal? So then I ended up transferring schools, thinking, well, that would help the problem. And so transferred schools, I was elevated to JV, and then I was having, I was like, arm troubles and in my rotator cuff. So I ended up having a surgery, and I was prescribed, I think it was Vicodin, after the surgery.
Right.
And so I guess that was like the first time I was like introduced to like any type of painkiller that wasn't like a Tylenol or Motrin. And I guess looking back, I don't know that that was like the start of like the trend downhill with being prescribed that, but I didn't really feel right after that. It was kind of like, oh, well, this makes me feel good and better. And I got this social situation that's just super awkward. But I can go to this. And so I was kind of like looking for things that I could use as a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
And so the surgery was one thing. And then with the while I was on the prescription, that was the next thing. But then what really was a detriment was hanging out with kind of the outcasts or the individuals that didn't have kind of
the outliers.
So we all kind of came together, and so we would get together and we would skip class from time to time. And since we weren't old enough to consume alcohol, ended up taking 32 cold and cough medicine pills. Overdose, was in the hospital for a couple days, and that was like, oh, okay, well, I can't do this, but I'm gonna do this. I used kind of that, unfortunately, that competitive spirit that I had of like, oh, my friends, they're taking 16, so I'm gonna take more because I'm competitive, not thinking about like the fact I might die, I might be.
You sound like a teenager.
Yeah.
You were just trying to feel better, trying to fit in. What would you say to that kiddo right now?
Oh, my gosh. And now it's so tough with the screens, so we didn't really have the screens with the iPads and the phones like we had. I guess it's a really hard question. I guess I would say that you don't need other things like substances or people that are going to build you up if that's not the healthiest thing for you. And I know kind of growing up, it's like, oh, I want to do things because I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not supposed to do this, so I'm gonna do this. And really just looking into yourself and say, like, what do I like to do? And go out from that route, and then hopefully have the family help and support, parents or grandparents, aunts and uncles, that will kind of support you and what you're doing. And so I think the family structure is huge too, because if family's not there, then it makes getting into that negative zone all the more easier, because it's like, oh, they don't care, they're not with me, and they're not supporting me. And it might not be that they're not supporting me because they don't want to. They might just not know. They might say, well, I'm not good at drawing, and she likes art, and whatever those things are. And so they might disengage from that instead of sitting with the child or the adolescent and asking them, what makes you feel good? Like when you do a subject at school, when you do a project, when you're playing a sport, what are those
things? So just talk to them.
Yes, communication.
Yeah. What is it like for you to kind of put yourself back into that mindset?
Oh, I mean, it's scary. I mean, because, there's...
Like scared, like you're kind of like shocked that you were able to get through it, or what's the scary part?
Yeah, I think shocked that... Yeah. I was able to get through it, given all the different extra hurdles that I gave to myself that I didn't need. That so many were self-induced, where I'd make a decision and like, okay, this isn't the right thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyways.
Mm. Well, given your competitive background, it's like if you didn't have those challenges anymore, you were getting bored and creating them for yourself.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, because I think, like there's something about teenagers and how they're evolutionarily, biologically wired to just think their parents are full of garbage at a certain point, so that they're able to kind of venture off. And it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Sure. And I think you mentioned screens and the ability of this generation to find people who are more like them, and we really didn't have that then.
No.
So you felt even more isolated. And not that you can't feel isolated in today's time, but every generation kind of has these unique challenges. And you kind of see that this was a particular barrier for you.
Yeah, it was a huge barrier. And even today, with the screens and being pulled in many different directions and what should I focus my time on, and know that I can't do everything, that I'm not a machine, that I can't compare myself to what a staff of 20 is doing and an organization that's been around 100 years versus our organization that's been around a lot less time in that comparison, and just doing what we think is going to help somebody and try not to worry about those external factors, but it's hard.
Oh, I bet. So it's almost like there's this perfectionism to you too, which I think tons of people can relate to, and how much that's such an issue and such a boundary and such a speed bump to doing anything. And a lot of time people say, well, that's an excuse, because then you can procrastinate and you never have to be done with it. But if you lean into that too far, then you never get anything done. You never help anybody. So how do you think you've been able to kind of overcome not only the competitiveness, which is a very positive thing, and a perfectionistic kind of tendency? How did you overcome that to be able to accomplish what you've done so far?
Yeah, so 6 years ago, really hit rock bottom, kind of mentally. Found myself in one of the psych wards at Akron General Hospital for 5 days. And that was, I say, like rock bottom, because no screens, on basically suicide watch, making sure that you're being safe and not harming yourself. And it really wasn't until then, even though that was like the lowest point, it was still, I say, starting that trend upwards, because I was starting to value who I was, minus the substances, minus the just the, all the other turmoil, all the things that I was bad habits that was bringing along. And so once I did that, and that was a hard decision, was married for, wasn't even 6 months. And so it was a voluntary thing where they weren't going to pink slip me in. They said, well, we can release you. You're not dying right now. Or we can bring you in, and here's what the average stay is, and you'll be evaluated. And I asked my wife, I was like, what do I do? And she's like, well, whatever you think you need to do. And up until that point, I was feeling that I knew all the answers, or I was able to find it through Google, or like, let me take this vitamin, it'll help me be less stressed, let me do this or do that. And that was at the point where I was selfless. I was like, I can't do anything on my own. And if this continues, then this could potentially be it for me, because I didn't have anything else I could really fall back on that I was doing that I felt was positive enough. And so when I made that decision, the whole asking for help, being put on medication, things that I was like, I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to be somebody that has to take medication.
Sure.
Because I want to do what I want to do, and I don't need that, and I can just get through this next situation. But I wasn't able to. I was in meetings at work and was feeling like I was passing out, so I'd have to leave, and all kind of awkward things. And I wasn't eating. I dropped 30 pounds, and I was like, I need help. And so, again, while that was the hardest part, I think it was also one of the best decisions that I've made, and I felt for the first time in a long time that I was able to like breathe. Just up until that point, you know, you read articles, you say, oh, here's 5 tips of, you know, reducing stress, go for a walk and do these things.
Right.
And I was doing those things, but there was just so much that I needed to unpack that if I didn't do that, none of those other things really mattered.
Right.
And so when I did that and started to just be a human and say, okay, I'm not, you know, some super person. Nobody is, and I shouldn't have felt like that anyways, but that whole feeling of, oh, I can handle everything, and you know, I'm going to be the breadwinner for the rest of my life, and so all these things have kind of really flipped the script, and that now my wife's the breadwinner, and I'm doing more kind of emotional tied work, but it's work that I like to do. It doesn't feel as much like work as what other things that I've done. And so there's that whole thing. And so looking back of what would I tell myself or tell a kid in that situation, that unfortunately society is built around making money and paying bills and all those things. But if you take that aside, if you find something that you like to do and continue on that road, and you'll slowly be able to turn that into a career at some level. And it's hard to see as somebody, you know, a kid growing up, but that's something that I wish in my 20s that Voices for Voices and sharing my mental health story, that I was able to accept it. I wish I was able to do that in my 20s instead of in my 30s. But I
would challenge you to say that you almost needed to go through what you did, because you have such an extreme compassion for the human condition. And if you hadn't have gone through it and you hadn't have overcome it, I don't think it'd be very relatable to the people that you're talking to, or, you know, your audience. So much to kind of unpack there, right?
Yeah.
So I think what you would tell yourself is find something you're passionate about. Find a purpose.
Yeah.
Without saying that, because a teenager may not be able to wrap their head around that. Mm-hmm. But just kind of pulling the threads to find out what makes them feel proud of themselves. Like, what is it?
Oh.
Right? I'm asking really hard questions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because
just something you're excited about, something you feel like
good
at.
Yeah, something you're good at. So one thing I was
unlock
also
the secret to the universe for us. Go.
Yeah, so I was, among other things, I was doing a lot of judging, not only to my peers in sports, out of sports, at school, out of school, but I was also, as the youngest child, my sister, she was like straight A student coming out of college, had 4 job offers, and she didn't have it easy by any stretch. But that's what I was at a family level. Like I was starting to like compare myself to. I'm like, oh, I'm like a C student.
Sure.
Maybe I should just go into the service. And so there was a time where I was like, oh, I'm going to do that. And then my parents were like, is this really what you want to do? And, you know, find something you like to do. And so I was just doing
a lot. So they were supportive.
Oh, they were supportive. And a lot of this was in my head. So it was nothing that my sister said, like, oh, look at me.
Right.
But when I, and even to this day, I have that look at me when I do things or I'm around things where I do something good. I'm like, look at this pic. Look what I did.
Yeah.
Because it's just that like validation that it, for whatever reason, it means, because I don't feel validated in other areas with you know, not having that.
It's just nice to hear, though, too.
It's nice to hear.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, look what I did. And so my sister would have all the A's, and then I would come home with like B's and like, Justin, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then I would get like 1 out of like 10 papers. I would get an A or a B plus, and I got a sticker, and those types of things where I was just not, I was not addressing them in my own mind, and it wasn't that my family was, they never talked down on me. They weren't like, oh, Heather's way up here, Justin, you're down here. It was just more something that was continued to be in my head, that I was like, oh, well, I'm going to be like my sister, so I'm going to go into accounting. Then I got into some of the higher level accounting classes. Like, I don't like this.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm a sophomore. I don't know what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I looked at criminal justice. So I took some criminal justice courses. And then I landed on, well, I don't want to have to go to school for an extra couple of years. Let me see if I can find something within the business college that I like, and so my roommate at the time, he was a marketing major, and he's like, hey, why don't you take a marketing course? And so I think that from having to give a presentation and be in front of people, even though that started with me drinking alcohol before presentations, because I was like super nervous and everybody's looking at me. That was like where the feeling of feeling good of here's something I like to do. I don't know how to go about doing this on like a more regular basis.
Okay.
Not the alcohol part.
The interviewing and standing in front of people and talking.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of research to suggest that the relationship among your siblings is actually more important than with your parents, because they always talk about the family constellation and how you grew up. And birth order is like the number one pop culture. People love hearing about birth order and how that affects your development and where you're at. But you have this competitive kind of spirit in the family that's not necessarily negative, because I don't know when competitiveness turned into such a negative thing, but my hope is that it's always competitive with yourself, not so much with the others around you. But what were some of the other, like, kind of unspoken laws or rules or spoken in your family?
I don't know. There weren't any that really jump out. Mm. Going to class, doing your homework.
Well, it sounds like showing up, because you weren't getting to these baseball events by yourself, and sometimes that's your entire weekend. You've got doubleheaders, you've got tripleheaders. So showing up, could that have been one that you're thinking about?
Yeah, showing up, being competitive, just trying your best. And now looking back, easier at the time, and say I didn't care in the sense that I wasn't analyzing every little thing that I was doing playing. I was just playing. I was just being a kid. I was batting. I was pitching. I was throwing. I was catching. And that part came natural, and it wasn't until the social isolation, the switching schools, the surgery, and all those things really started to creep in,
and I'm like, not being how you anticipated or how they were promised to you.
Yeah, my name's not on the list for this team. Yeah. Like, what's going on? Like, didn't they come out and see and talk to the coaches and what's going on? So then I started doubting myself, going, well, obviously there's something wrong with me, because all these years I was at this top level, and there should have been no reason why I wasn't continuing that.
Right. Yeah. You're almost describing to me like this muddling through.
Yeah.
Kind of just like showing up, going through the motions, and that could have relied on that. Hey, you show up, you do the best you can with what you got, and then what you have that day is what you have.
Yes.
Okay. So it's almost like, okay, we get to college, we find this, we're like, that was kind of fun. Like, it made me nervous, but because you wanted to do a good job. Yeah. And then you're like, okay, I'm connecting to being in front of people.
Yeah.
Go from there.
Yeah, that was big. It really was. I was looking after that kind of initial presentation of, hey, I like doing this, even though like it terrified me and everybody's looking at me, and even though they don't, not listening, and like it's just ingrained in my head. And I started to look for organizations that I was able to do that, to have presenting opportunities. So there was an organization called Students and Free Enterprise. We went to Purdue for a weekend event, and I was able to also, be a college student and go out and do the partying thing, but then also have a chance to be able to present at the end of the competition. And our school did good, and we were able to get a second place out of, I think, 6 or 7 teams, and got a scholarship for the school. And so I think that was another catalyst of like, oh, I like that, even though it's terrifying and I get nervous, I like doing it, and that anticipation of, oh, well, I'm going to put in the time now so I feel like I know the content when I'm speaking, whatever that might be, instead of reading from a script, which is still okay to do.
Sure.
But in situations and that I've learned from then, feedback and just being authentic. If I don't have 100% of a script, that I kind of go with the flow and how I'm feeling, that hopefully that'll connect a little bit more with the audience. So like, oh, okay, like that's he's just a regular person.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he's doing these things and part of his organization, and you know, do the traveling and all these things. But he, at the end of the day, he's just having a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's almost like the beautiful things that adrenaline can do if you open it up a little bit.
Yes, and I was taking the energy and time that I was putting into predominantly alcohol in my 20s and 30s, and taking that energy and putting it into positive things. I often get asked, like, how do you have the energy? Do you drink coffee? And I don't. I'm just using what I now know, like the ADHD and OCD.
Sure.
I'm using that energy and that mindset to do these things. And so as we were talking earlier about some things that are coming up and things that we've recently done, that to somebody that isn't like-minded or entrepreneurial and spirit, trying to explain like the thought process of what I'm working on now, mm-hmm. that might not come to fruition for 6 months or 3 months mm-hmm. or a year. Because I think so much of our society is like, what are we doing now? What are we doing
That's
today?
It. That's it.
And mm-hmm. so if I'm doing something, like, okay, well, why are you doing it? Who are you doing it with? How are you getting paid? And all these things come up and say, well, there's things that, from a planning perspective, you just have to look out a little bit into the future. And I like to think that if you don't invest kind of in yourself and what you're doing, then it's just going to be tough. And so that's where I think some of the you know, the experiences and the traveling and the meeting different people and interviewing and talking and just going out and doing it. Like, well, why are you doing that? You didn't have to do that. We were talking earlier about, and this episode will air after we do this, but we're, as an organization, giving an award, the Voice of the Year, to one of our previous guests, Tyrus. And so he's in New York City most of the time doing his work with Fox News. And so I decided, hey, like, why... we don't have hundreds of thousands of followers and those things. Like, how can we help elevate our brand and our organization? And so we're going to fly there for a day, meet with him in person, mm-hmm. and present an award, get a couple pictures, and be able to post that and share that. And so that whole, like, in-person thing, I think, is going to be big. And you know, answering, you know, some of the critics, like, well, why are you doing this? Or, you know, bringing politics into it. It's like, it's not about that. It's about an individual who has a platform and it is just being themselves.
Yeah.
When we were talking to him, he said that I'm not given an agenda of what to speak about. I can just be myself. And he was speaking about being a dad and a husband and his career, going from being a professional wrestler and to other things he wanted to do. So all things us as individuals, we do. And so whether you're in New York or LA or Chicago, wherever, you know, those are things that, like, we can take some of his experience and other experience and just relate and say, yeah, like, he does this thing, it's relatable. He's a father, he's a dad. He's just given his opinion, and that's where kind of Voices for Voices, we're trying to share that and share the varying opinions and mm-hmm. the various voices of individuals from, you know, a person on the front line in the Ukraine war to somebody like Ramona Robinson or Tyrus or Temple Grandin or Judy Rubin. And many, many more.
Mm-hmm. So there's so much that I heard in there that I think was really good. Kind of going back to, we're in a time where everything is politicized.
Yes.
And when you're talking about voices for voices and not feeling this need to remain neutral, but connect with the things that you as a human being connect to as them as a human being.
Oh, absolutely. And nothing more so than the trip we took in late May and early June going to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And so I tell people, like, we don't necessarily agree with everything a particular country or particular people are doing, but there are people that are being affected. And so by going and traveling and seeing individuals in a wartime and experiencing the air raid sirens and all these things that here in the U.S. we luckily don't have, to be able to just bring some of those voices back of, you know, here are individuals, and whether we agree on, you know, why and what's going on, there's individuals that they have to make a living, that still pay their bills. Mm-hmm. They can't be holed up in a bomb shelter for a super extended period of time because there's still bills to pay and different things. And so some questions are like, well, you know, how, you know, seeing some of the pictures, I guess, of our trip, you were like, oh, well, this is Ukraine. This is in war. We're sending billions of dollars to them. But the thing is that the air raid sirens, they're not on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's different periods of time and different areas that happen. And so by being there, being out in the main square and then air raid sirens go off and then going into a bomb shelter for, you know, half hour or so, you know, being able to just experience that and try to share some of that experience of some of the things that I know I've taken advantage and been ungrateful for in the past. I mean, just like shelter and food and security.
Safety.
Yeah.
Because when I first met you, I think you were still like on a little bit of a high. Your heart was full.
Yeah.
When you came back. But it was dangerous at times.
Oh, absolutely. It was very dangerous. I had to definitely take many safety, security precautions with different types of, you know, bulletproof clothing and, and the likes to just be as safe as possible and to really trust that the contacts that I had who had invited me there weren't just bringing me into some trap to be captured and, you know, and the like. So I had to have a lot of trust in people I really didn't know all that well. If I look at, well, you know, you have friends and, you know, for many years and
a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend at that
point.
It's
like, okay, well, we're taping a show and then they get invited and it's like, well, I'm going to be over in the region, maybe I can sneak a trip in there, and then those things really started to get in my mind, like, why not? And so I think that's what some of what separates our organization and what we're trying to do of trying to be bold. And so these things that we're some of the things we're doing, they are bold, and we don't have to do them. And some of them, you know, the safety is hard to. Hard at times of, you know, for instance, being at 80 degree weather and having, you know, bulletproof clothing on makes it super hot, being on transportation with no air conditioning. And so there's just things that
you're uncomfortable,
with, but wanting to continue to do it. And let's say like we're lucky to be able to make it through and say, okay, well, how can we continue on this journey that while we're helping people here at home in Northeast Ohio, but we, as an organization, we want to help everybody. So I have this huge goal of trying to help 3 billion people. And the incredible part about that is we just, as a brand, we just hit close to 3 billion people worldwide who have seen our brand. So there was
congratulations. That's
thank
amazing.
You. It
That's
is.
A huge deal.
And I never thought. I mean, I put this goal, and I didn't think it would happen in a year. So the EWTN Network has a show, Living Right with Dr. Ray, And the school, Walsh University, I teach at, they just happened last year to be taping 4 episodes of this show. And so I was like, I'll go to the taping. And I wear my Voices for Voices shirt. And 3 of the 4 shows, I was able to like, ask a question on camera, and it didn't get edited out. And I didn't realize the reach that the show has, that across the world, they're reaching close to 1 billion people like wow. per week, because the show, I think, airs 2 or 3 times a week. So all those together, it reaches close to 1 billion. And so I was on 3 of the 4 with asking question with the logo visible. Mm-hmm. And so was able to do something that like I didn't have to do it. My wife was probably like, why are you going down just to be in the audience? And yeah. I had no idea that I would have an opportunity.
Yeah.
But as I started to see how things were unfolding, before they started filming the 1 episode, the producer asked the audience if anybody had a question. And so I was sitting there going, like, I didn't know, like, this was even a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I was like, oh, they'll probably edit it out. You know, they'll take what they want. And so the first taping, I didn't ask a question. But after the first one, I went right up to the producer and said, I have a question. And I just thought of one. Wrote it down. He said, I'll go ask Dr. Yeah. Ray. And it just worked out. And the camera angles, they weren't straight on, but they were angled enough to be able to see the logo and the brand, and then we were able to see the website traffic after those of mm-hmm. people checking out, like, you know, what we
this?
Do, what
yeah.
is this organization?
Yeah.
And so I go and tell somebody kind of growing up in kind of adolescent phase that, you know, so much of society tries to be against us dreaming and doing
sure.
something kind of out of the ordinary, that go ahead and dream. And if something comes to your heart and that passion's there, go for it, because you never know. I was thinking the $3 billion would come over 20 years of getting the brand out and doing social media posts and trying to do all these things, and here something really fell into my lap and mm-hmm. not knowing. And then luckily been on really good terms with the president of the university, who we had on an earlier show, and he was the one actually in between shows. He goes, oh, this is sweet, you wore your shirt.
Yeah.
And he wasn't saying, like, oh, you didn't have your wall shirt on. It
mm-hmm.
was just,
mm-hmm.
like, hey, you wore your, he goes, now we got to get you on TV.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, from then, I went straight to the producer and
yeah.
said, hey, I got this. And then I just continued with it. And the episodes took close to 1 year for them to air. And so this whole planning that I've kind of alluded to, of we want things now and today and there are things we have to do for today, but there are things like that story that it took close to 12 months for it to really come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And we happened to be at Disney World, you know, my family, my daughter, my wife, I forget what ride we were waiting in line for, but I pulled it up on my phone, and my parents are at home, and they had the show on, and I didn't know if it was going to be edited out
mm-hmm.
because
the question mm-hmm.
yeah, or like they're only going to show the angle from the back mm-hmm. and not, and so I didn't even know. So all this time goes by, not sure if it's actually going to happen, and when it did, and I couldn't hear very well, so I texted my mom and said, like, could you see the, because I mean I'm looking on my phone
mm-hmm.
and I was like,
you don't get the scope,
yeah. the scope of like the screen. And she said, no, you could see it. And she took screenshots.
Wow.
And so that's just something that's very small now. Have we gotten huge amounts of donations since then? No. But it's a piece in the puzzle that is helping build and shape the organization and to give credibility to the organization and things that we're doing, that we're really trying to reach out again to the talk about, you know, politics and different areas. Like, we're trying to give everybody that wants to share their voice a platform to do so.
So you're almost describing like these serendipitous situations.
Yes.
And then you are there to seize them.
Yes.
Like you step up, you stood up, you asked the question, and I can't imagine your stomach doing backflips, and you're describing the anxiety that you feel standing up in front of people, let alone on that platform, knowing that it was going to go out to those people. What was that like for you to get that call from your mom and get that screenshot?
Oh, it was awesome. It was validating that what something that I did came to fruition. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, okay, yep. Yeah, it was a good idea in that I did it,
yeah.
And should I have went and taped those episodes, or should I have stayed home or done different things? There are, again, the serendipitous things where they happen, and then just the way my brain's wired, that when those things come up now, I just do them. I say, like, if it's not going to bankrupt me or my family and they're not illegal, I got to at least look into it. If there's a chance, then I'll give it a shot, and then I can, in my mind, fall back on these positive things that happen, free from substance and free from kind of that social isolation, and just be, hopefully, for the rest of the time I'm on Earth, be able to share and help as many people.
Mm. Well, it brings up like the sports quote that I remember, like the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I don't remember if it's Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, but it's like everyone said, Albert Einstein said it, so we'll just go with that. Or like, you know, Mark Twain said it, that's mm-hmm. the quote. But it's like you are just constantly making these choices to move forward, to kind of go, you know, in the direction that you're headed. You have an ultimate goal, you don't know exactly what it looks like, it's kind of malleable, mm-hmm. but the fundamental is connecting humans to humans.
It is.
And okay, so you also kind of described to me like these negative voices, this criticism. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that you had mentioned when you came back from Ukraine, and people are like, why are you doing that? That's so dangerous. Mm-hmm. Why are you putting yourself in, you know, in harm's way and blah, blah, blah. You have a family, you have a child, you know, blah, blah, blah. What do you wish those people knew about you doing these like kind of like, it's not even high risk behavior. It's just kind of putting yourselves mm-hmm. in position to be around people that they perceive as being dangerous.
Yeah, I think this comes back to passion, and that hopefully people see the passion, the foundation, look to, you know, whether it's social media or a website, look at the things we've done with events and names of people who are somebodies and people that aren't somebody.
You mean like Dr. Stacey Haight, obviously.
Right.
Go
on. Or even myself. Like, that's like why am I doing this? And
yeah.
So I think just knowing that at the root of everything, of we're really just trying to help people. And I think it comes in all shapes and sizes and flavors, that we might not agree with everybody on every single issue, which I don't think anybody ever does.
No.
But to give them an opportunity. Now, if they don't want to share, and you know, that's on them. And if they don't want to invest or be a part of the organization or be as kind as you were and say, hey, like, I'm down if you want to do a flip the script episode.
Yeah.
And so if you hadn't said that, we wouldn't be doing this.
Right.
And so this wouldn't be shared at the depth that we've gotten to. So I really hope that people see like the genuineness under everything that might look sensational, of like these trips and these people and awards and all these things. Like that, I feel like that comes with the territory. You can either wait until the time comes and until something falls into the lap, some things do, some things don't, or like with the voice of your award that we're going to be giving to Tyrus, of making something happen,
right.
Reaching out on his website or his social media, and who knows, maybe he says yes, maybe he says no, maybe I don't get an answer, but I got an answer, and we did it. And so I'm like, can I send you a thank you card? Gave me the address to their home,
mm-hmm.
Send a thank you card. And then as my mind was thinking with our event in October of how can I do something to continue to elevate us as an organization before the end of the year. And I started to think, like, well, we're doing awards, like, this would be a great idea. So I waited to get confirmation that it was going to happen, that it wasn't going to be through Zoom like our interview was.
Right.
For the show, that it was going to be where I can actually meet him and hand it to him and get pictures and those types to get the photo op.
Absolutely.
And so making individuals that even if they've received awards and are making a lot of money and famous, that people like to be recognized.
Yes.
So as much as I like wanted to be recognized so much growing up and even now, where it's like, look what I did. Look,
yeah.
look, here's my mental health story. Like, yeah. Here's my book, and you'll go buy it. As much as we want to do that, that if we just stay within ourselves and continue that passion, that even family members might not 100% be on board, like, yeah. Well, what's he doing? He's
I
always
think
on
they
that
rarely
computer.
Are. If you're somebody who's looking outside the scope of what was accomplished by your family, you know, me being a first-generation college student and all the kind of the barriers that I've run into, when you dream big, there's going to be few people with you. And yeah. One thing that I wish somebody had told me, I know I'd mentioned in an interview, is mm-hmm. Winning and being successful can be extremely isolating. So that isolation that you felt during your adolescence, I can't help but think that's mirrored, but in a positive way. Because when you win the gold medal, you're up on the stand by yourself.
Right.
And then nobody's with you.
Yeah, and that adrenaline.
Oh, yeah.
And once that event or that thing is done, then it's like, well, now what?
Yeah.
What am I going to do next?
Yeah.
Okay. I did this thing, and yeah. Like, I
so this is a fear for you. You get anxiety thinking about what happens after I
oh, yeah.
achieve a goal.
So, yeah, so in between, yeah. Like, now, yeah, doing, yeah, do thing one or thing two.
Yeah.
And have something come in 3 months. Like, what would I do in between then? And trying to really fill that time, not that I fear of, I don't say fear of being alone, but I at the beginning of Voice of Voices and before I wrote my mental health story at House of You, Prescription for a Living, my therapist is like, you know, why don't you, like, share that? And it's like, no, there's a lot of personal things that,
yeah.
Like, in-laws and people, like, that share and, like, want to talk about and have that be seen at the world. But then that thought was,
the
like,
vulnerability.
The
of
vulnerability.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where I was like, okay, well, I did the book. I did this trip. I did this event. I met this person. We
yeah.
Did, you know, 100 episodes in the first year that we overshot in a good way the amount of episodes we thought we would do, and that we're going to be able to be grateful and continue that.
Mm.
And so, yeah, when there is downtime, I do. Like, there's some time like, oh, well, I need to fill that time with, like, what can I do next, or can I just take a step back and breathe? And
yeah.
So I'm kind of in that spot of continue thinking, but then also breathing and
being present.
And one thing I'll add in here towards the end is my first therapist out of the hospital, I said, I'm afraid I'm going to never, you know, I'm afraid that I'm going to, you know, accomplish this thing or these things. And then, like, what am I going to do next? Like, I'm afraid that I'm going to, like, think yeah. of something to come up. And he said, he goes, oh, you're not going to, he goes, you might feel that, but that's not going to happen. And so I've had to, in those times of being like, okay, it's okay to take a day or two and not do anything related, or, you know, take a couple hours and not do something, or do something
yes.
fun, or go
yeah.
buy a book, or do something that is not related at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes the best self-care is doing nothing. And in a society where we're addicted to being efficient and being effective and getting something done, sometimes doing nothing is the best thing you can do.
Yeah.
So
I want to thank you. Is there what else do we not?
So let's do like a let's spill the tea a little bit.
Oh geez.
Talk to me about of the 103 interviews mm-hmm. that you've done. Which did you find like the most inspiring?
Oh,
so you can
gosh.
Plug some of your...
Yeah. So Dr. Judy Rubin, who was the art lady on the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood, that was awesome because she was able to talk about not just the art therapy side of things of what her specialty was in teaching,
yeah.
but also about how that translated over to the camera and what was being seen. And her not thinking, she's like, I'm not an actress. And Fred Rogers was like, that's why I want you on, is because you're not. Awesome. You're just being yourself. And you have this specialty of what you like to do. And that's what we're really trying to do, is show people how different individuals are and be able to just relate. And so I think a little bit of her thought was the same of, I got to think of this big thing to do. And all she had to do is just be herself.
Yeah.
And for me, that's where I try to draw some inspiration of, I don't have to recreate the wheel. There are some things that are going to be like other organizations. But if I try not to judge myself or the organization versus others, and I stay within myself and just stay passionate, that even the most loved celebrity or artist that's out there, not every single person that loves them, that there's going to be people that don't. So I need to just think, like, there's going to be people that, like, we're finding, I guess, in a good way, in a competitive sense, of trying to steal a bunch of our ideas, yeah, and things that we're doing. And so it's like, how much do we want to share? And so there's all these things of, like, well, we want to share them, but we know people are pulling bits and pieces. So one thing that we're going to be doing with this past event that we had, our third annual Brand New Day event, is we're going to be putting that behind a paywall. So all the people that say, oh, I couldn't make the event, like, okay, we have this now available, and so you can make a $50 donation, and then you'll get the, it's like another product, and then they download it, and then they can see it. So if somebody wants to find things out, they got to at least do that. And that's where I had to just stop and value what we're doing, on a sense of, like, everybody wants to be part of a winner and jump on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing that I found is trying to keep that lead, or just continue thinking of extra things to do. And I need to just be okay if people are like, I can't believe you're charging this. It's like, do you pay your bills? How do you pay your bills? Like, okay, so I mean, here's a nonprofit. Like, did you know the Cleveland Clinic and all these other organizations, they have people that are being paid. They're not doing it. And so that's one thing I've learned through some of the interviews of the show as well, of knowing that we just need to value our time and our worth, and say if we're putting a lot of time and energy into something, then we shouldn't feel bad of asking others, absolutely, of saying, hey, like, make a donation, and if you don't
want
to.
You can't be shy. You can't be shy about it either, and that's one of the hugest barriers, I think, for any entrepreneur. Number one is getting rejected. Like, you got to be comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Number two is you got to be able to ask for money unapologetically.
Unapologetically.
Because what you're doing is so much value. You're doing an excellent job. Oh. It seems like you're having fun.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else that you're excited for that we should watch?
Keep your eye open. We'll be...
The Tyrese Awards is coming.
Tyrese Award will be coming, so... You'll have seen that before this episode airs in December. And then keep your eyes and ears open. We have another mission trip coming up to a location we're not going to share at this point. But it will be another bold trip that will continue to help people across the world and right here in Northeast Ohio.
Very exciting. Good stuff.
Right.
Thanks for sharing.
Thanks for joining, Stacy, and flipping the script and asking some really hard questions. But it's good. It felt good and feels good to share that. And really hope that this episode, as well as all the other episodes that we have, will help at some level for individuals. So thank you again, Stacy. And again, episode 98 is the episode we filmed and aired with Stacy Hayes, so please check that out. Until next time, I am Justin Allen Hayes, founder and executive director of Voices for Voices. Please be a voice for you or somebody in need.